Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As you know, we are proceeding on Zoom today. The next case on our calendar is A24-0395, Stacy Lee Rowe versus State of Minnesota. With me today are Judges Sleater and Larson. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll just remind you to please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I've been practicing criminal law for about 40 years, and I find this case very disturbing. Frankly, I think that what happened to my client is disproportionate. This was her first offense. The probation officer recommended no probation, which was probably wrong. She had a relatively minor offense involved compared to her husband. I argue that the defense counsel's activity fell below the objective standard of reasonableness. The claim that there was an excellent chance of probation in this case, was frankly problematical. It did not fairly represent the consequences of the plea deal. In this case, the counsel said that she had an excellent chance for probation. Frankly, I don't see it. There's a mandatory minimum of 144 months, an optional mandatory minimum, of course. But the other thing that defense counsel did that I find
Mr. Mack, I think you just said twice that counsel said that Ms. Rowe had an excellent chance at probation. The district court, relying on the transcript testimony, used the phrase "good chance." Where is the word "excellent" found in the transcript, or why are you saying that, suggesting that counsel told Ms. Rowe that she had an excellent chance at probation?
I think that that's in the transcript of the hearing that she had before the judge in my case. I
Right.
can't.
That's what I'm looking at. So, okay, but you think that's in the transcript?
I think it's in the transcript, but I'm
Okay.
not sure that the difference between good and excellent is terribly important in this case.
Okay.
I think that what's important here is this: Ms. Rowe pled guilty thinking that she was probably going to get probation, and there are reasons why she may have thought that, even though it was incorrect. The probation officer, for example, recommended that she get probation with no prison time. I find that a little bit surprising under the nature of this particular court, but I can see why, when my client had that probation in her pocket, that she thought that she was going to get probation. I'd like to concentrate too on the issue of anything between probation and 144 months, because that seems to be wildly disproportionate. In a case like this, I'm sure that the reason that my client decided to go for the po post-conviction relief was that she was sent to Shakopee, and there were all kinds of women in Shakopee. Frankly, sexual misconduct is one of the most common reasons that women get sent to Shakopee, that they were getting much more mild sentences for things that they did, which were probably much worse. My client had one episode in this case like this,
Mr.
and she
Mack,
had.
just to clarify, Mr. Mack, though, that was a guideline sentence, correct? I mean, so it
That's
was not a
correct. Yeah, it was a guideline sentence and it was a mandatory minimum, but it was an optional mandatory minimum.
And let me bring, well, the reason I get to that, I assume the certainly that is a significant difference from probation, a stayed sentence, but I don't know that it really plays into our legally into our analysis of your client's appeal. But I want to focus on the wouldn't it be true, effectively, that while maybe not an excellent chance, and we can look at the transcript again, but certainly when probation recommends a stayed sentence, that's consistent with a good chance, wouldn't you say, of probation, at least in my experience, because you're right, in a case like this, it would have been rare to see a probation report making that recommendation, but I would have paid a very good attention to that and inquired in more detail as to why. So that at least would support a good chance for probation, would it not?
Of course. And I did not think that the trial court judge dealt in any detail or adequately with the probation determination. Why, when you get a stayed sentence on a mandatory minimum of 144, I think that the trial court judge owes the defendant and the superior courts an indication why she is completely ignoring the probation report, as opposed to saying why I think it was wrong, or I think that we can come to some compromise between nothing and 144 months. I
So,
also think.
here the focus is on the Strickland test and counsel's conduct, not the basis for the judge's decision, correct? In terms of whether to award probation or impose the prison sentence.
I think you
Not
have to
award, but
consider,
whether
I'm
to.
sorry. I think you have to consider both. Because one of the things that the respondent, in this case the appellant, is arguing is that counsel told her she had a right to argue for a downward departure. And I submit that that's problematical too, because now we're talking about the counsel's actions, because that's a non-right. My client's counsel could have argued for a downward departure without that being a condition of the guilty plea. And she's basically being told something that, while not completely untrue, is certainly misleading. The other thing that counsel does that I find very problematical is that, having argued to my client and to the court for a downward departure, he then discourages an appeal and doesn't talk about the possibility of her appealing with a public defender. The Strickland test, yes, is right. That's a two-part test. Was the advice given misleading? And I submit that it was. But the other thing that's problematical about it, it's clear that what my client says indicates that she would not have taken this deal if she would known that she had less than a good chance of getting a stayed sentence.
Well, the district court concluded in its opinion that there was no allegation that she would have proceeded to trial but for this advice. So, and in fact, in your brief, you suggest that if the plea is withdrawn, she would probably plead guilty again. So, how did the district court abuse its discretion in its determination on the second prong that
Because,
she hadn't shown prejudice?
well, for one thing, my client is not claiming that she would have proceeded to trial, period. What she indicates is that she would not have accepted that and would have negotiated further rather than plead guilty. So, what we're talking about, and what I'm talking about in this case, is not that my client shouldn't have gotten anything or that she shouldn't have gotten prison. What I'm talking about is she shouldn't have gotten 144 months. And I think that not opening that possibility was an abuse of discretion. Consider, too, the other matter that should have been in the court's mind. My client's actions here were relatively minor compared to the actions done by her ex-husband. Her ex-husband had multiple indications of abuse. My client had one indication of abuse. So I'm saying that she would not have taken the plea agreement, and that's the essence of it, had her client's attorney properly informed her of what was going on and properly informed of her of the probabilities. After Padilla, the cases are pretty clear that you don't have to have anything that is an outright a lie or an outright misstatement. It's simply the case that you don't inform properly. And I submit in this case, my client was not informed properly, and therefore she should be allowed to withdraw her appeal. Questions? Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mack. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Your Honor, may it please the court, counsel, Michael Lieber, Chief Deputy County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. To be honest, I'm not quite sure where to start. This is not a sentencing appeal. This is a petition for post-conviction relief claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. And under Strickland, in the context of plea withdrawal, Ms. Rowe has to show that but for the deficient performance of counsel, she would not have pleaded guilty. Not just that she would have engaged in additional plea negotiations, but she would not have pleaded guilty and insisted on going to trial. Counsel seems to affirm that that's not the prejudice that she is even claiming. She's not claiming she wouldn't have gone to trial. She seems to be claiming I would have renegotiated. That to me answers the question, and that's the factual finding that the court, district court made, which is not clearly erroneous. And given counsel's statement, there is no prejudice in this case.
So, Mr. Lieber, are you relying on the Ellis Strong case for the proposition that that to meet the second prong in the context of a guilty plea, the inquiry is whether there's a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's errors, the client would have pleaded, would not have pleaded guilty and instead would have gone to trial?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's fairly well settled law that prejudice in the context of plea withdrawal isn't just I wouldn't have taken this deal and would have gotten another deal. I would not have pleaded guilty and I would have insisted on my right to trial because that's in essence what we're talking about, plea of guilty versus going to trial.
Are you aware of any case law that would support Mr. Mack's proposition that it's not simply whether the defendant would go to trial, but whether, or the client would go to trial, but whether the client may have chosen to pursue a different plea opportunity?
I'm not aware of any authority in that regard. And again, mainly because the whole focus on, the claim is you are giving up your constitutional right to trial by pleading guilty. And then the focus is the plea is wrong because you were deprived of that right to have your trial. It's not I would have engaged in additional negotiation. And I'm not sure how we would live in that world if another all it took was another attorney to come in and say, hey, I could have gotten a better deal. Therefore, I've shown prejudice. And the last thing I'll say is Mr. Mack's comment that a departure or the right to argue for departure was no right at all. I'd remind the court that what Ms. Rowe was charged with was criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, and the state had filed a Blakely notice. The exposure Ms. Rowe had was 360 months. Mr. Anderson, Ms. Rowe's attorney, negotiated for the state to give up its Blakely or pursuit of an aggravated sentence and the right to argue for a dispositional or durational departure. If you recall from the record, the original offer was either agree to was agree to 144 months and we'll give up our right to pursue an aggravated sentence. So in this case, that was something that was negotiated for that benefited Ms. Rowe. I don't think Mr. Mack would ever recognize or does not has never recognized that 360 months was the maximum exposure that Miss Rowe was facing. Your Honor, the court's factual findings about Mr.
Mr. Lieber,
Anderson's. Yes,
before
sir.
you get into that, just to clarify, my understanding is Mr. Mack's point wasn't with regard to the former issue, the Blakely. Certainly, I don't think there's a dispute that was a benefit, but it was the second half of that, her right, so-called right to request departure. As I understood, it was simply that she could have made that without it being a part of an agreement. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, but then that would have been a straight up plea, and her maximum exposure would have been 360 months, not just 144 months. If
Well,
that's
just to clarify, why could not there have been an agreement to I'm not sure I understand that. The point being is the key of the agreement was the dropping of the Blakely. It could remain silent with regard to her request for departure, and yet she could still legally request a departure. In other words, the state couldn't oppose that in that scenario.
No, but in order, but that's the nature of the plea agreement, Your Honor, is you start off with what she was charged with, Crim Sex 1, and the Blakely notice. That's what she was charged with. She could have chosen to go to trial. That's door one. Door two is a plea agreement. But without negotiating for the removal of the Blakely notice and the maximum exposure of 360 months, yes. The only way that that could have happened was her pleading straight up without the benefit of the plea agreement. Any other discussion about, well, what would have been a better plea agreement? Could they have negotiated this? Could they have negotiated that? One, that's not what the factual record shows. The point I understood Mr. Mack to be making was there was really no benefit, to Miss Rowe by having the right to argue for a departure. And I'm saying there absolutely was a benefit. She lowered her exposure to 144 months as a cap.
I have a question for you about the first prong and Helen's argument relating to the district court's order. The district court on page six of its order states that, to find it here, but that basically, that there have to be factual allegations for counsel's statements to amount to an objectively unreasonable representation. Is that an accurate description of the law? I think appellant disputes that.
Well, I think both of those are red herrings. One, no, I don't think that's accurate in regards to the issue of plea withdrawal here. I think what both Mr. Mack and what the district court are talking about really is that line of cases that talks about advice on collateral consequences, whether that be immigration or whatever. The line of cases that I'm relying on are the promises, the promises that are made, that induce the plea. And the line of cases that I'm relying on say, if she was promised a probationary sentence, then she might have a basis for withdrawal. If you go back to the whole why there was an evidentiary hearing here, there was an affidavit that was submitted with the petition that seemed to allege that Mr. Anderson told Miss Rowe that he was quite certain that she would get probation. That could have been deemed a promise, and which is what justified the evidentiary hearing where we could take Miss Rowe's testimony. Unfortunately for Miss Rowe, that's not what she testified to. She testified to that her attorney told her she had a good chance at probation. And just simply telling your client they have a good chance is simply an opinion of counsel. And in this case, given the later recommendation by probation of a probationary sentence, it wasn't bad advice. The fact that it didn't come true does not make it deficient performance or ineffective assistance of counsel. So again, to me, that whole misadvice really is a red herring. It doesn't have any place in this particular case. It's really about what advice, what was she told? And she basically said she was never promised probation. Her plea petition says she wasn't promised probation, or no other promises were made to her. The plea petition and the record made at the plea hearing made it clear that she had the chance to argue at probation. The fact that she didn't get it does not equate to ineffective assistance of counsel.
Mr. Lieberg, do you know? I didn't see it in the record, but that might be because we were dealing with a post-conviction petition hearing itself. At sentencing, did the judge, what I would do typically, or my practice was, even when I knew there was a departure, is I would inform the defendant, you should presume you're going to prison. And then I would follow up and with that presumption, do you still wish to proceed with a plea of guilty? And I'm curious if some similar colloquy occurred in this case, if you know.
I don't believe so. I looked at the transcript. There was reference to dispositional and durational departures and the right to argue for probation. I think that's how counsel couched it, is basically the right to argue for a dispositional or durational departure. But part of this, is she was represented by counsel. No record's been made that she was misadvised, like was never told what those terms meant. The only thing Ms. Rowe testified to is I kept hearing I had a good chance at probation, which again wasn't factually wrong. It was the advice of counsel. And under the facts of this case, the plea agreement that was reached was a good deal. The fact that she ended up going to prison doesn't negate the fact that the plea agreement here that was negotiated gave her the best chance at what she wanted, which was probation. There's no indication, ever testified directly in that hearing that, wait a minute, I was told I was never going to prison, or I didn't understand what those terms meant. That wasn't in her testimony. Because she was represented by counsel, we don't have any other information in the record. Again, it is the petitioner's burden to produce those facts that justify relief. And there's no indication that she didn't know that this was going to be up to the judge. And in fact, I think that's what she testifies to. She understood that it was going to be up to the judge whether she went to prison or not.
Any further questions from the panel? Any concluding remarks, Mr. Lieberg?
Nope, Your Honor, I would simply ask the court to affirm there was no abuse of discretion in denying the petition in this case. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any rebuttal, Mr. Mack?
Yes, Your Honor. First, I'd like to focus on Padilla and the cases from Minnesota that I cited in my brief that talk about Padilla. I don't think that the law in Minnesota anymore is that it has to be an incorrect talking about by the defense counsel. I think it's simply bad advice. And I think in this case, we have bad advice. We talked about the difference between excellent chance and good a chance. And I don't think there's a hair's worth of difference between the two of them. The fact is that she was told she had a good chance. She was indicated by probation that she had a good chance. I'd like to focus just a minute too on the fact that she had a danger that there was going to be a determination of more than 144 months. I think that's very improbable in a case like this. You had a one-off incident. You had an indication where her role was relatively minor compared to her husband, and we had a probation officer that's indicating that she should get a complete stay and not go to prison at all. I think she was misadvised in this case, and the case should be reversed. Thank you.
All right, any further questions from the panel? All right. Well, thank you both for your arguments here today. They were very helpful. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Be safe. It's a pretty cold out there.
It is indeed.
Thank you, Your Honor.